so hard that for a moment, Bobby thought he decided to go along with his corner boy friends after all. Inside the pawn shop, an old man with a pair of glasses pushed up on his bald head looked around, annoyed, then back down at the newspaper he was reading.
"The jefes in the long yellow coats," Dee breathed. "I've seen those guys. Some of the others seen them, too. You don't want to mess with boys like that, Chico. Something wrong with those boys. They don't look right. Make the bad boys hang around Mallory's saloon look like good boys."
Something in Dee's expression reminded Bobby of Sully John, and he remembered S.J. saying he'd seen a couple of weird guys outside Commonwealth Park. When Bobby asked what was weird about them, Sully said he didn't exactly know. Bobby knew, though. Sully had seen the low men. Even then, they had been sniffing around.
"When did you see them?" Bobby asked. "Today?"
"Cat, give me a break," he said. "I ain't been up but 2 hours. And most of that I've been in the bathroom making myself pretty for the street. I seen them coming out of the corner pocket, a pair of them, day before yesterday, I think."
"And that place, funny lately." He thought for a moment, then called, "Yo, Juan, get your ass over here." The crew cut puller came trotting over. Dee spoke to him in Spanish. Juan spoke back, and Dee responded more briefly, pointing to Bobby. Juan leaned over Bobby, hands on the knees of his sharp pants.
"You seen these guys, huh?"
Bobby nodded.
"One bunch in a big purple DeSoto, one bunch in a Chrysler, one bunch in a Olds 98.
Bobby only knew the DeSoto, but he nodded.
"Those cars ain't real cars,"
Juan said. He looked sideways at Dee to see if Dee was laughing. Dee wasn't. He only nodded for Juan to keep going.
"They ain't something else."
"I think they're alive," Bobby said.
Juan's eyes lit up. "Yeah, like alive. And those men.
What do they look like? I've seen one of their cars, but not them." Dee translated some of it, but in an absent fashion, more and more he was conversing with Juan and ignoring Bobby. The other corner boys, and boys were what they really were, Bobby saw, drew close and added their own contributions. Bobby couldn't understand their talk, but he thought they were scared, all of them. They were tough enough guys. Down here you had to be tough just to make it through the day, but the low men had frightened them all the same. Bobby caught one final clear image, a tall, striding figure in a calf-length mustard-colored coat, the kind of coat men sometimes wore in movies like Gunfight at the O.K. Corral and the Magnificent Seven.
"I see 4 of them coming out of that barber shop with the horse parlor in the back,"
the one who seemed to be named Filio said.
"That's what they do, those guys. Go into places and ask questions. Always leave one of their big cars running at the curb. You'd think you'd be crazy to do that down here, leave a car running at the curb, but who'd steal one of those goddamn things?"
No one, Bobby knew. If you tried, the steering wheel might turn into a snake and strangle you. The seat might turn into a quicksand pool and drown you.
"They come out all in a bunch,"
Filio went on.
"All wearing those long yellow coats, even though the day's so hot you could fry the egg on the fucking sidewalk. They was all wearing those nice white shoes, sharp. You know, I always notice what people got on their feet. I get hard for that shit. And I don't think.
He paused, gathering himself, and said something to Dee in Spanish. Bobby asked what he'd said.
"He's saying their shoes wasn't touching the ground."
Juan replied. His eyes were big. There was no scorn or disbelief in them.
"He's saying they got this big red Chrysler, and when they go back to it, their fucking shoes ain't quite touching the ground."
Juan forked 2 fingers in front of his mouth, spat through them, then crossed himself. No one said anything for a moment or two after that, and then Dee bent gravely over Bobby again.
"These are the guys looking for your friend."
"That's right," Bobby said. "I have to warn him."
He had a mad idea that Dee would offer to go with him to the corner pocket, and then the rest of the Diablos would join in. They would walk up the street, snapping their fingers in unison like the Jets in West Side Story. They would be his friends now, gang guys who happened to have really good hearts. Of course, nothing of the sort happened. What happened was Mosso wandered off back toward the place where Bobby had walked into him. The others followed. Juan paused long enough to say,
"You run into those caballeros and you gonna be one dead putino, tio mio."
Only Dee was left, and Dee said, "He's right.
You ought to go back to your own part of the world, my friend. Let your amigo take care of himself.
I can't, Bobby said. And then, with genuine curiosity, could you?
Not against ordinary guys, maybe, but these ain't ordinary guys. Was you just listen?
Yes, Bobby said. But you crazy little boy. Poco loco. I guess so. He felt crazy, all right. Poco loco and then some. Crazy as a shithouse mouse, his mother would have said. Dee started away, and Bobby felt his heart cramp. The big boy got to the corner. His buddies were waiting for him on the other side of the street, then wheeled back, made his finger into a gun, and pointed it at Bobby. Bobby grinned and pointed his own back.
Vaya con Dios, mi amigo loco, Dee said,
then sauntered across the street with the collar of his gang jacket turned up against the back of his neck. Bobby turned the other way and started walking again, detouring around the pools of light cast by fizzing neon signs and trying to keep in the shadows as much as he could. Across the street from the corner pocket was a mortuary. The Spengy Funeral Parlor, it said on the green awning. Hanging in the window was a clock whose face was outlined in a chilly circle of blue neon. Below the clock was a sign which read, Time and Tide Wait for No Man. According to the clock, it was 8:20. He was still in time, in plenty of time, and he could see an alley beyond the pocket where he might wait in relative safety. But Bobby couldn't just park himself and wait, even though he knew that would be the smart thing to do. If he'd really been smart, he never would have come down here in the first place. He wasn't a wise old owl. He was a scared kid who needed help. He doubted if there was any in the corner pocket, but maybe he was wrong. Bobby walked under the banner reading, Come in, it's cool inside. He had never felt less in need of air conditioning in his life. It was a hot night, but he was cold all over. God, if you're there, please help me now. Help me to be brave and help me to be lucky. Bobby opened the door and went in. The smell of beer was much stronger and much fresher, and the room with the pinball machines in it banged and jangled with lights and noise. Where before only Dee had been playing pinball, there now seemed to be at least 24 guys, all of them smoking, all of them wearing strap-style undershirts and Frank Sinatra Hello Young Lovers hats, all of them with bottles of Bud parked on the glass tops of the Gottlieb machines. The area by Len Files' desk was brighter than before because there were more lights on in the bar where every stool was taken, as well as in the pinball room. The pool hall itself, which had been mostly dark on Wednesday, was now lit like an operating theater. There were men at every table, bending and circling and making shots in a blue fog of cigarette smoke. The chairs along the walls were all taken. Bobby could see old G with his feet up on the shoeshine posts and, What the fuck are you doing here? Bobby turned, startled by the voice and shocked by the sound of that word coming out of a woman's mouth. It was Alana Files. The door to the living room area behind the desk was just swinging shut behind her. Tonight, she was wearing a white silk blouse that showed her shoulders, pretty shoulders, creamy white and as round as breasts, and the top of her prodigious bosom. Below the white blouse were the largest pair of red slacks Bobby had ever seen. Yesterday, Alana had been kind, smiling, almost laughing at him, in fact, although in a way Bobby hadn't minded. Tonight she looked scared to death. I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to be in here, but I need to find my friend Ted, and I thought that he heard his voice shrinking like a balloon that's been let loose to fly around the room. Something was horribly wrong. It was like a dream he sometimes had, where he was at his desk studying spelling or science or just reading a story, and everyone started laughing at him, and he realized he had forgotten to put his pants on before coming to school. He was sitting at his desk with everything hanging out for everyone to look at, girls and teachers and just everyone. The beat of the bells in the game room hadn't completely quit, but it had slowed down. The flood of conversation and laughter from the bar had dried up almost entirely. The click of pool and billiard balls had ceased. Bobby looked around, feeling those snakes in his stomach again. They weren't all looking at him, but most were. Old G was staring with eyes that looked like holes burned in dirty paper, and although the window in Bobby's mind was almost opaque now, soaped over, he felt that a lot of the people in here had sort of been expecting him. He doubted if they knew it, and even if they did, they wouldn't know why. They were kind of asleep, like the people of Midwich. The low men had been in. The low men had...
Get out, Randy, Alana said in a dry little whisper. In her distress, she had called Bobby by his father's name. Get out while you still can.
Old G had slid out of the shoeshine chair. His wrinkled seersucker jacket caught on one of the foot pedestals and tore as he started forward, but he paid no attention as the silk lining floated down beside his knee like a toy parachute. His eyes looked more like burned holes than ever.
Get him, Old G said in a wavery voice. Get that kid.
Bobby had seen enough. There was no help here. He scrambled for the door and tore it open. Behind him, he had the sense of people starting to move, but slowly, too slowly, Bobby Garfield ran out into the night. He ran almost two full blocks before a stitch in his side forced him to first slow down and stop. No one was following, and that was good. But if Ted went into the corner pocket to collect his money, he was finished, done, kaput. It wasn't just the low men he had to worry about. Now there was old G and the rest of them to worry about, too, and Ted didn't know it. The question was, what could Bobby do about it? He looked around and saw the storefronts were gone. He'd come to an area of warehouses. They loomed like giant faces from which most of the features had been erased. There was a smell of fish and sawdust and some vague rotted perfume that might have been old meat. There was nothing he could do about it. He was just a kid, and it was out of his hands. Bobby realized that, but he also realized he couldn't let Ted walk into the corner pocket without at least trying to warn him. There was nothing Hardy Boys heroic about this either. He simply couldn't leave without making the effort. And it was his mother who had put him in this position. His own mother.
I hate you, Mom,
he whispered. He was still cold, but sweat was pouring out of his body. Every inch of his skin felt wet. I don't care what Don Biderman and those other guys did to you. You're a bitch and I hate you. Bobby turned and began to trot back the way he had come, keeping to the shadows. Twice he heard people coming and crouched in doorways, making himself small until they had passed by. Making himself small was easy. He had never felt smaller in his life. This time he turned into the alley. There were garbage cans on one side and a stack of cartons on the other full of returnable bottles that smelled of beer. This cardboard column was half a foot taller than Bobby, and when he stepped behind it, he was perfectly concealed from the street. Once, during his wait, something hot and furry brushed against his ankle, and Bobby started to scream. He stifled most of it before it could get out, looked down and saw a scruffy alley cat looking back up at him with green headlamp eyes.
Scat, Pat,
Bobby whispered and kicked at it. The cat revealed the needles of its teeth, hissed, then did a slow strut back down the alley, weaving around the clots of refuse and strews of broken glass, its tail lifted in what looked like disdain. Through the brick wall beside him, Bobby could hear the dull throb of the corner pocket's juke. Mickey and Sylvia were singing Love is Strange. It was strange, all right. A big, strange pain in the ass. From his place of concealment, Bobby could no longer see the mortuary clock, and he lost any sense of how much or how little time was passing. Beyond the beer and garbage reek of the alley, a summer street life opera was going on. People shouted out to one another, sometimes laughing, sometimes angry, sometimes in English, sometimes in one of a dozen other languages. There was a rattle of explosions that made him stiffen. Gunshots was his first idea, and then he recognized the sound as firecrackers, probably lady fingers, and relaxed a little again. Cars blasted by, many of them brightly painted rail jobs and jack jobs with chrome pipes and glass-packed mufflers. Once there was what sounded like a fistfight with people gathered around yelling encouragement to the scufflers. Once a lady, who sounded both drunk and sad, went by singing "Where the Boys Are" in a beautiful, slurry voice. Once there were police sirens, which approached and then faded away again. Bobby didn't doze exactly, but fell into a kind of daydream. He and Ted were living on a farm somewhere, maybe in Florida. They worked long hours, but Ted could work pretty hard for an old guy, especially now that he'd quit smoking and had some of his wind back. Bobby went to school under another name, Ralph Sullivan, and at night they sat on the porch, eating Ted's cooking and drinking iced tea. Bobby read to him from the newspaper, and when they went into bed, they slept deeply, and their sleep was peaceful, interrupted by no bad dreams. When they went to the grocery store on Fridays, Bobby would check the bulletin board for lost pet posters or upside-down file cards advertising items for sale by owner, but he never found any. The low man had lost Ted's scent. Ted was no longer anyone's dog, and they were safe on their farm. Not father and son, or grandfather and grandson, but only friends. Guys like us. Bobby thought drowsily. He was leaning against the brick wall now, his head slipping downward until his chin was almost on his chest. Guys like us. Why shouldn't there be a place for guys like us? Lights splashed down the alley. Each time this had happened, Bobby had peered around the stack of cartons. This time he almost didn't. He wanted to close his eyes and think about the farm, but he forced himself to look, and what he saw was the stubby yellow tail fin of a checker cab just pulling up in front of the corner pocket. Adrenaline flooded Bobby and turned on lights in his head he hadn't even known about. He dodged around the stack of boxes, spilling the top two off. His foot struck an empty garbage can and knocked it against the wall. He almost stepped on a hissing furry something, the cat again. Bobby kicked it aside and ran out of the alley. As he turned toward the corner pocket, he slipped on some sort of greasy goo and went down on one knee. He saw the mortuary clock and its cool blue ring, 9:45. The cab was idling at the curb in front of the corner pocket's door. Ted Brodigan was standing beneath the banner reading, "Come in, it's cool inside," paying the driver. Bent down to the driver's open window like that, Ted looked more like Boris Karloff than ever. Across from the cab, parked in front of the mortuary, was a huge Oldsmobile as red as Alana's pants. It hadn't been there earlier, Bobby was sure of that. Its shape wasn't quite solid. Looking at it didn't just make your eyes want to water, it made your mind want to water. "Ted!" Bobby tried to yell, but no yell came out. All he could produce was a straw-like whisper. Why doesn't he feel them, Bobby thought. How come he doesn't know? Maybe because the low men could block him out somehow? Or maybe the people inside the corner pocket were doing the blocking. Old G and all the rest, the low men had perhaps turned them into human sponges that could soak up the warning signals Ted usually felt. More lights splashed the street. As Ted straightened and the checker pulled away, the purple DeSoto sprang around the corner. The cab had to swerve to avoid it. Beneath the streetlights, the DeSoto looked like a huge blood clot decorated with chrome and glass. Its headlights were moving and shimmering like lights seen underwater. And then they blinked. They weren't headlights at all. They were eyes. "Ted!" Still, nothing but that dry whisper came out, and Bobby couldn't seem to get back on his feet. He was no longer sure he even wanted to get back on his feet. A terrible fear, as disorienting as the flu and as debilitating as a cataclysmic case of the squitters, was enveloping him. Passing the blood clot DeSoto outside the William Penn Grill had been bad. To be caught in its oncoming eye lights was 1,000 times worse. No, 1,000,000 times. He was aware that he had torn his pants and scraped blood out of his knee. He could hear Little Richard howling from someone's upstairs window, and he could still see the blue circle around the mortuary clock like a flashbulb afterimage tattooed on the retina, but none of that seemed real. Nastagansett Avenue suddenly seemed no more than a badly painted backdrop. Behind it was some unsuspected reality, and reality was dark. The DeSoto's grill was moving.
Snarling, those cars ain't real cars, Juan had said. They're something else.
They were something else, all right.
Ted!
A little louder this time. And Ted heard. He turned toward Bobby, eyes widening, and then the DeSoto bounced up over the curb behind him, its blazing, unsteady headlights pinning Ted and making his shadow grow as Bobby's and the Sigsby girl's shadows had grown when the pole light came on in Spicer's little parking lot. Ted wheeled back toward the DeSoto, raising one hand to shield his eyes from the glare. More light swept the street. This time it was a Cadillac coming up from the warehouse district, a snot-green Cadillac that looked at least a mile long, a Cadillac with fins like grins and sides that moved like the lobes of a lung. It thumped up over the curb just behind Bobby, stopping less than a foot from his back. Bobby heard a low, panting sound. The Cadillac's motor, he realized, was breathing. Doors were opening in all three cars. Men were getting out, or things that looked like men at first glance. Bobby counted six, counted eight, stopped counting. Each of them wore a long, mustard-colored coat, the kind that was called a duster, and on the right front lapel of each was the staring crimson eye Bobby remembered from his dream. He supposed the red eyes were badges. The creatures wearing them were... what? Cops? No, a posse like in a movie that was a little closer. Vigilantes? Closer still, but still not right. They were... they're regulators. Like in that movie me and SJ saw at the Empire last year, the one with John Payne and Karen Steele. That was it. Oh, yes. The regulators in the movie had turned out to be just a bunch of bad guys. But at first you thought they were ghosts or monsters or something. Bobby thought that these regulators really were monsters. One of them grasped Bobby under the arm. Bobby cried out. The contact was quite the most horrible thing he had ever experienced in his life. It made being thrown against the wall by his mother seem like very small change indeed. The low man's touch was like being grasped by a hot water bottle that had grown fingers, only the feel of them kept shifting. It would feel like fingers in his arm, but then like claws. Fingers, claws, fingers. That unspeakable touch buzzed into his flesh, reaching both up and down. It's Jack's stick, he thought crazily, the one sharpened at both ends. Bobby was pulled toward Ted, who was surrounded by the others. He stumbled along on legs that were too weak to walk. Had he thought he would be able to warn Ted? That they would run away together down Narragansett Avenue, perhaps even skipping a little the way Carol used to? That was quite funny, wasn't it? Incredibly, Ted didn't seem afraid. He stood in the semicircle of low men, and the only emotion on his face was concern for Bobby. The thing gripping Bobby, now with a hand, now with loathsome pulsing rubber fingers, now with a clutch of talons, suddenly let him go. Bobby staggered, reeled. One of the others uttered a high, barking cry and pushed him in the middle of the back. Bobby flew forward and Ted caught him. Sobbing with terror, Bobby pressed his face against Ted's shirt. He could smell the comforting aromas of Ted's cigarettes and shaving soap, but they weren't strong enough to cover the stench that was coming from the low men. A meaty, garbagey smell, and a higher smell, like burning whiskey that was coming from their cars. Bobby looked up at Ted. It was my mother, he said. It was my mother who told. This isn't her fault, no matter what you may think, Ted replied. I simply stayed too long.
But it was a nice vacation, Ted?
One of the low men asked. His voice had a gruesome buzz, as if his vocal cords were packed with bugs, locusts, or maybe crickets. He could have been the one Bobby spoke to on the phone, the one who said Ted was their dog. But maybe they all sounded the same. If you don't want to be our dog, too, stay away, the one on the phone had said. But he had come down here anyway, and now, oh, now. Wasn't bad, Ted replied.
I hope you at least got laid, another said, because you probably won't get another chance.
Bobby looked around. The low men stood shoulder to shoulder, surrounding them, pinning them in their smell of sweat and maggoty meat, blocking off any sight of the street with their yellow coats. They were dark-skinned, deep-eyed, red-lipped, as if they'd been eating cherries. But they weren't what they looked like. They weren't what they looked like at all. Their faces wouldn't stay in their faces, for one thing. Their cheeks and chins and hair kept trying to spread outside the lines. It was the only way Bobby could interpret what he was seeing. Beneath their dark skins were skins as white as their pointed rete petite shoes. But their lips are still red, Bobby thought. Their lips are always red. As their eyes were always black, not really eyes at all, but caves. And they are so tall, he realized, so tall and so thin. There are no thoughts like our thoughts in their brains, no feelings like our feelings in their hearts. From across the street there came a thick, slobbering grunt. Bobby looked in that direction and saw that one of the Oldsmobile's tires had turned into a blackish-gray tentacle. It reached out, snared a cigarette wrapper, and pulled it back. A moment later, the tentacle was a tire again, but the cigarette wrapper was sticking out of it like something half-swallowed.
"Ready to come back, hoss?"
one of the low men asked Ted. He bent toward him, the folds of his yellow coat rustling stiffly, the red eye on the lapel staring.
"Ready to come back and do your duty?"
"I'll come," Ted replied, "but the boy stays here." More hands settled on Bobby, and something like a living branch caressed the nape of his neck. It set off that buzzing again, something that was both an alarm and a sickness. It rose into his head and hummed it like a hive. Within that lunatic hum he heard first one bell tolling rapidly, then many. A world of bells in some terrible black night of hot hurricane winds. He supposed he was sensing, wherever the low men had come from, an alien place trillions of miles from Connecticut and his mother. Villages were burning under unknown constellations. People were screaming, and that touch on his neck, that awful touch. Bobby moaned and buried his head against Ted's chest again.
"He wants to be with you," an unspeakable voice crooned. "I think we'll bring him, Ted. He has no natural ability as a breaker, but still all things serve the king, you know."
The unspeakable fingers caressed again. "All things serve the beam," Ted said in a dry, correcting voice, his teacher's voice.
"Not for much longer," the low man said and laughed.
The sound of it loosened Bobby's bowels.
"Bring him,"
said another voice. It held a note of command. They did all sound sort of alike, but this was the one he had spoken to on the phone, Bobby was sure.
"No,"
Ted said. His hands tightened on Bobby's back. "He stays here."
"Who are you to give us orders?" the low man in charge asked. "How proud you have grown during your little time of freedom, Ted. How haughty. Yet soon you'll be back in the same room where you have spent so many years with the others. And if I say the boy comes, then the boy comes."
"If you bring him, you'll have to go on taking what you need from me," Ted said. His voice was very quiet, but very strong. Bobby hugged him as tight as he could and shut his eyes. He didn't want to look at the low men, not ever again. The worst thing about them was that their touch was like Ted's, in a way. It opened a window.
But who would want to look through such a window? Who would want to see the tall, red-lipped scissor shapes as they really were? Who would want to see the owner of that red eye?
You're a breaker, Ted. You were made for it. Born to it. And if we tell you to break, you'll break, by God.
You can force me. I'm not so foolish as to think you can't. But if you leave him here, I'll give what I have to you freely. And I have more to give than you could... Well, perhaps you could imagine it.
I want the boy,
the low man in charge said, but now he sounded thoughtful, perhaps even doubtful.
I want him as a pretty, something to give the king.
I doubt if the Crimson King will thank you for a meaningless pretty if it interferes with his plans, Ted said. There is a gunslinger.
Gunslinger!
Ha! Yet, he and his friends have reached the borderland of Endworld, Ted said. And now, he was the one who sounded thoughtful. If I give you what you want instead of forcing you to take it, I may be able to speed things up by 50 years or more. As you say, I'm a breaker made for it and born to it. There aren't many of us. You need everyone, and most of all you need me, because I'm the best.
You flatter yourself and you overestimate your importance to the king.
Do I? I wonder. Until the beams break, the dark tower stands. Surely I don't need to remind you of that. Is one boy worth the risk? Bobby hadn't the slightest idea what Ted was talking about and didn't care. All he knew was that the course of his life was being decided on the sidewalk outside a Bridgeport billiard parlor. He could hear the rustle of the low men's coats. He could smell them. Now that Ted had touched him again, he could feel them even more clearly. That horrible itching behind his eyes had begun again, too. In a weird way, it harmonized with the buzzing in his head. The black specks drifted across his vision, and he was suddenly sure what they meant, what they were for. In Clifford Simak's book, Ring Around the Sun, it was a top that took you off into other worlds. You followed the rising spirals. In truth, Bobby suspected it was the specks that did it. The black specks, they were alive. And they were hungry.
Let the boy decide, the leader of the lowmen said at last. His living branch of a finger caressed the back of Bobby's neck again. He loves you so much, Teddy. You're his tika, aren't you? That means destiny's friend, Bobby. Oh, isn't that what this old smoky-smelling teddy bear is to you? Your destiny's friend.
Bobby said nothing, only pressed his cold, throbbing face against Ted's shirt. He now repented coming here with all his heart, would have stayed home hiding under his bed if he had known the truth of the lawmen, but yes, he supposed Ted was his tika. He didn't know about stuff like destiny. He was only a kid, but Ted was his friend. Guys like us, Bobby thought miserably, guys like us.
So, how do you feel now that you see us? The low man asked. Would you like to come with us so you can be close to good old Ted? Perhaps see him on the odd weekend? Discuss literature with your dear old tika? Learn to eat what we eat and drink? What we drink.
The awful fingers again caressing. The buzzing in Bobby's head increased. The black specks fattened. And now they looked like fingers, beckoning fingers.
We eat it hot, Bobby,
the low man whispered.
And drink it hot as well. Hot and sweet. Hot and sweet.
Stop it, Ted snapped.
Or would you rather stay with your mother?
The crooning voice went on, ignoring Ted.
Surely not. Not a boy of your principles.
Not a boy who has discovered the joys of friendship and literature. Surely you'll come with this wheezy old Kamai, won't you? Or will you? Decide, Bobby. Do it now. And knowing that what you decide is what will bide. Now and forever.
Bobby had a delirious memory of the lobsterback cards blurring beneath McQuown's long white fingers. Now they go, now they slow, now they rest. Here's the test. I fail, Bobby thought. I fail the test. Let me go, mister, he said miserably. Please don't take me with you.
Even if it means your tea car has to go on without your wonderful and revivifying company?
The voice was smiling, but Bobby could almost taste the knowing contempt under its cheery surface, and he shivered with relief because he understood he was probably going to be let free after all. With shame, because he knew what he was doing, crawling, chintzing, chickening out. All the things the good guys in the movies and books he loved never did. But the good guys in the movies and books never had to face anything like the lowmen in the yellow coats or the horror of the black specks. And what Bobby saw of these things here outside the corner pocket was not the worst of it either. What if he saw the rest? What if the black specks drew him into the world where he saw the men in yellow coats as they really were? What if he saw the shapes inside the ones they wore in this world? Yes, he said, and began to cry.
Yes, what?
Even if he has to go without me? And even if it means going back to your mother? Yes.
You perhaps understand your bitch of a mother a little better now, do you?
Yes, Bobby said for the third time. By now he was nearly moaning. I guess I do. That's enough, Ted said. Stop it. But the voice wouldn't. Not yet.
You've learned how to be a coward, Bobby. Haven't you?
Yes, he cried, still with his face against Ted's shirt. A baby. A little chicken shit baby. Yes, 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 I don't care. Just let me go home. He drew in a great, long, unsteady breath and let it out in a scream. I want my mother! It was the howl of a terrified little one who has finally glimpsed the beast from the water, the beast from the air.
All right, the low man said, since you put it that way. Assuming your teddy bear confirms that he'll go to work with a will and not have to be chained to his oar as previously.
I promise. Ted let go of Bobby. Bobby remained as he was, clutching Ted with panicky tightness and pushing his face against Ted's chest until Ted pushed him gently away.
Go inside the pool hall, Bobby. Tell Files to give you a ride home. Tell him if he does that, my friends will leave him alone.
I'm sorry, Ted. I wanted to come with you. I meant to come with you, but I can't. I'm so sorry.
You shouldn't be hard on yourself.
But Ted's look was heavy, as if he knew that from tonight on, Bobby would be able to be nothing else. Two of the yellow coats grasped Ted's arms. Ted looked at the one standing behind Bobby, the one who had been caressing the nape of Bobby's neck with that horrible stick-like finger. They don't need to do that, Cam. I'll walk.
Let him go, Cam said.
The low man holding Ted released his arms. Then for the last time, Cam's finger touched the back of Bobby's neck. Bobby uttered a choked wail. He thought, if he does it again, I'll go crazy. I won't be able to help it. I'll start to scream, and I won't be able to stop. Even if my head bursts open, I'll go on screaming.
Get inside there, little boy. Do it before I change my mind and take you anyway.
Bobby stumbled toward the corner pocket. The door stood open but empty. He climbed a single step, then turned back. Three of the low men were clustered around Ted, but Ted was walking toward the blood clot DeSoto on his own. Ted! Ted turned, smiled, started to wave. Then the one called Cam leaped forward, seized him, whirled him, and thrust him into the car. As Cam swung the DeSoto's back door shut, Bobby saw, for just an instant, an incredibly tall, incredibly scrawny being standing inside a long yellow coat, a thing with flesh as white as new snow and lips as red as fresh blood. Deep in its eye sockets were savage points of light and dancing flecks of darkness in pupils which swelled and contracted as Ted's had done. The red lips peeled back, revealing needly teeth that put the alley cats to shame. A black tongue lolled out from between those teeth and wagged an obscene goodbye. Then the creature in the yellow coat sprinted around the hood of the purple DeSoto, thin legs, gnashing thin knees, pumping and plunged in behind the wheel. Across the street, the old started up, its engine sounding like the roar of an awakening dragon. Perhaps it was a dragon. From its place, skewed halfway across the sidewalk, the Cadillac's engine did the same. Living headlights flooded this part of Narragansett Avenue in a pulsing glare. The DeSoto skidded in a U-turn, one fender skirt scraping up a brief train of sparks from the street, and for a moment, Bobby saw Ted's face in the DeSoto's back window. Bobby raised his hand and waved. He thought Ted raised his own in return, but could not be sure. Once more, his head filled with a sound like hoofbeats. He never saw Ted brought again.
Bug out, kid,
Len Files said. His face was cheesy white, seeming to hang off his skull the way the flesh hung off his sister's upper arms. Behind him, the lights of the Gottlieb machines in the little arcade flashed and flickered with no one to watch them. The cool cats, who made an evening specialty of corner pocket pinball, were clustered behind Len Files like children. To Len's right were the pool and billiard players, many of them clutching cues like clubs. Old G stood off to one side by the cigarette machine. He didn't have a pool cue. From one gnarled old hand there hung a small automatic pistol. It didn't scare Bobby. After Cam and his yellow coat friends, he didn't think anything would have the power to scare him right now. For the time being, he was all scared out. Put an egg in your shoe and beat it, kid, now. Better do it, kiddo. That was Alana, standing behind the desk. Bobby glanced at her and thought, if I was older, I bet I'd give you something. I bet I would. She saw his glance, the quality of his glance, and looked away, flushed and frightened and confused. Bobby looked back at her brother. You want those guys back here? Len's hanging face grew even longer. Are you kidding? Okay then, Bobby said. Give me what I want and I'll go away. You never see me again. He paused. Or them.
What you want, kid?
Old G asked in his wavering voice. Bobby was going to get whatever he asked for. It was flashing in old G's mind like a big bright sign. That mind was as clear now as it had been when it had belonged to young G, cold and calculating and unpleasant. But it seemed innocent after Cam and his regulators. Innocent as ice cream. A ride home, Bobby said. That's number one. Then speaking to old G rather than Len, he gave them number two. Len's car was a Buick. Big, long, and new. Vulgar, but not low. Just a car. The two of them rode to the sound of dance band music from the 40s. Len spoke only once during the trip to Harwich. Don't you go tuning that to no rock and roll. I have to listen to enough of that shit at work.
They drove past the Asher Empire, and Bobby saw it was a life-sized cardboard cutout of Brigitte Bardot standing to the left of the ticket booth. He glanced at it without very much interest. He felt too old for BB now. They turned off Asher. The Buick slipped down Broad Street Hill like a whisper behind a cupped hand. Bobby pointed out his building. Now the apartment was lit up all right. Every light was blazing. Bobby looked at the clock on the Buick's dashboard and saw it was almost 11 p.m. As the Buick pulled to the curb, Len Files found his tongue again. Who were they, kid? Who were those gonifs? Bobby almost grinned. It reminded him of how at the end of almost every Lone Ranger episode, someone said, "Who was that masked man?" "Low men," he told Len. "Low men in yellow coats. I wouldn't want to be your pal right now." "No," Bobby said. A shudder shook through him like a gust of wind. "Me neither. Thanks for the ride." "Don't mention it. Just stay the fuck clear of my felts and greens from now on. You're banned for life." The Buick, a boat, a Detroit cabin cruiser, but not low, drew away. Bobby watched as it turned into a driveway across the street and then headed back up the hill past Carol's building. When it had disappeared around the corner, Bobby looked up at the stars. Stacked billions. A spilled bridge of light. Stars and more stars beyond them, spinning in the black. "There is a tower," he thought. "It holds everything together. There are beams that protect it somehow. There is a crimson king. And breakers working to destroy the beams, not because the breakers want to, but because it wants them to, the Crimson King." Was Ted back among the rest of the breakers yet? Bobby wondered, back and pulling his oar. "I'm sorry," he thought, starting up to walk to the porch. He remembered sitting there with Ted reading to him from the newspaper, just a couple of guys. "I wanted to go with you, but I couldn't. In the end, I couldn't." He stopped at the bottom of the porch steps, listening for Bowser around on Colony Street. There was nothing. Bowser had gone to sleep. It was a miracle. Smiling wanly, Bobby got moving again. His mother must have heard the creak of the second porch step. It was pretty loud because she cried out his name. And then there was the sound of her running footsteps. He was on the porch when the door flew open and she ran out still dressed in the clothes that she had been wearing when she came home from Providence. Her hair hung around her face in wild curls and tangles. "Bobby," she cried out. "Bobby, oh Bobby, thank God, thank God." She swept him up, turning him around and around in a kind of dance, her tears wetting one side of his face. "I wouldn't take their money," she babbled. "They called me back and asked for the address so that they could send a check, and I said, never mind, it was a mistake. I was hurt and upset. I said no, Bobby. I said no. I said I didn't want their money." Bobby saw she was lying. Someone had pushed an envelope with her name on it under the foyer door. Not a check. $300 in cash. $300 for the return of their best breaker. 300 lousy rocks. They were even bigger cheapskates than she was. "I said I didn't want it, did you hear me?" Carrying him into the apartment now. He weighed almost 100 pounds and was too heavy for her, but she carried him anyway. As she babbled on, Bobby realized they wouldn't have the police to contend with, at least she hadn't called them. Mostly she had just been sitting here plucking at her wrinkled skirt and praying incoherently that he would come home. She loved him. That beat in her mind like the wings of a bird trapped in a barn. She loved him. It didn't help much, but it helped a little. Even if it was a trap, it helped a little. "I said I didn't want it. We didn't need it. They could keep their money. I said, I told them." "That's good, Mom." He said, "That's good. Put me down." "Where have you been? Are you all right? Are you hungry?" He answered her questions back to front. "I'm hungry, yeah, but I'm fine. I went to Bridgeport. I got this." He reached into his pants pocket and brought out the remains of the bike fund money. His ones and change were mixed into a messy green wad of tens and twenties and fifties. His mother stared at the money as it rained down on the end table by the sofa, her good eye growing bigger and bigger until Bobby was afraid it might tumble right out of her face. She looked like a battered old pirate gloating over freshly unburied treasure, an image Bobby could have done without, and one which never entirely left him during the 15 years between that night and the night of her death. Yet some new and not particularly pleasant part of him enjoyed that look, how it rendered her old and ugly and comic, a person who was stupid as well as avaricious. "That's my ma," he thought in a Jimmy Durante voice. "That's my ma. We both gave him up, but I got paid better than you did, ma, didn't I? Yeah. Hacha." "Bobby," she whispered in a trembly voice. She looked like a pirate and sounded like a winning contestant on that Bill Cullen show, The Price is Right. "Oh, Bobby, so much money. Where did it come from?" "Ted's bet," Bobby said. "This is the payout." "But Ted, won't he—" "He won't need it anymore." Liz winced as if one of her bruises had suddenly twinged. Then she began sweeping the money together, sorting the bills even as she did so. "I'm going to get you that bike," she said. Her fingers moved with the speed of an experienced three-card Monte dealer. "No one beats that shuffle," Bobby thought. "No one has ever beaten that shuffle. First thing in the morning, soon as the Western Auto opens, then we'll go—" "I don't want a bike," he said. "Not from that and not from you." She froze with her hands full of money, and he felt her rage bloom at once, something red and electrical. "No thanks from you, are there? I was a fool to ever expect any. God damn you if you're not the spitting image of your father." She drew back her hand again with the fingers open. The difference this time was that he knew it was coming. She had blindsided him for the last time. "How would you know?" Bobby asked. "You've told so many lies about him, you don't remember the truth." And this was so. He had looked into her, and there was almost no Randall Garfield there. Only a box with his name on it. His name, and a faded image that could have been almost anyone. This was the box where she kept the things that hurt her. She didn't remember about how he liked that Joe Stafford song, didn't remember, if she'd ever known, that Randy Garfield had been a real sweetie who'd give you the shirt right off his back. There was no room for things like that in the box she kept. Bobby thought it must be awful to need a box like that. "He wouldn't buy a drunk a drink," he said. "Did you know that?"
"What are you talking about?"
"You can't make me hate him, and you can't make me into him." He turned his right hand into a fist and cocked it by the side of his head. "I won't be his ghost. Tell yourself as many lies as you want to about the bills he didn't pay and the insurance policy he lost out on and all the inside straights he tried to fill, but don't tell them to me. Not anymore."
"Don't raise your hand to me, Bobby O. Don't you ever raise your hand to me."
In answer, he held up his other hand, also fisted. "Come on. You want to hit me? I'll hit you back. You can have some more, only this time you'll deserve it. Come on." She faltered. He could feel her rage dissipating as fast as it had come, and what replaced it was a terrible blackness. In it, he saw, was fear. Fear of her son. Fear that he might hurt her. Not tonight, no, not with those grimy little boy fists, but little boys grew up. And was he so much better than her that he could look down his nose and give her the old la-di-da? Was he any better? In his mind, he heard the unspeakable crooning voice asking if he wanted to go back home, even though it meant Tib would have to go on without him. "Yes," Bobby'd said. "Even if it meant going back to his bitch of a mother, yes," Bobby'd said. "You understand her a little bit better now, do you?" Cam had asked, and once again Bobby had said, "Yes." And when she recognized his step on the porch, there had at first been nothing in her mind but love and relief. Those things had been real. Bobby unmade his fists. He reached up and took her hand, which was still held back to slap, although
now without much conviction. It resisted at first, but Bobby at last soothed the tension from it. He kissed it. He looked at his mother's battered face and kissed her hand again. He knew her so well, and he didn't want to. He longed for the window in his mind to close, longed for the opacity that made love not just possible, but necessary. The less you knew, the more you could believe. "It's just a bike I don't want," he said. "Okay, just a bike." "What do you want?" she asked. Her voice was uncertain, dreary. "What do you want from me, Bobby?" "Pancakes," he said. "Lots." He tried to smile. "I am so hungry." She made enough pancakes for both of them, and they ate breakfast at midnight, sitting across from each other at the kitchen table. He insisted on helping her with the dishes, even though it was going on toward one by then. "Why not?" he asked her. There was no school the next day. He could sleep as late as he wanted. As she was letting the water out of the sink and Bobby was putting the last of their silverware away, Bowser began barking over on Colony Street, "Roof, roof, roof," into the dark of a new day. Bobby's eyes met his mother's. They laughed, and for a moment, knowing was all right. At first he lay in bed the old way, on his back with his heels spread to the lower corners of the mattress, but the old way no longer felt right. It felt exposed, as if anything that wanted to bag a boy could simply burst out of his closet and unzip his upturned belly with one claw. He rolled over on his side and wondered where Ted was now. He reached out, feeling for something that might be Ted. And there was nothing, just as there had been nothing earlier on nasty Gansett Street. Bobby wished he could cry for Ted, but he couldn't. Not yet. Outside, crossing the dark like a dream, came the sound of the clock in the town square, one single bong. Bobby looked at the luminous hands of the Big Ben on his desk and saw they were standing at 1 o'clock. That was good. "They're gone," Bobby said. "The low men are gone." But he slept on his side with his knees drawn up to his chest. His nights of sleeping wide open on his back were over.
Eleven. Wolves and lions, Bobby at bat, Officer Raymer, Bobby and Carol, bad times, an envelope. Sully John returned from camp with a tan, 10,000 healing mosquito bites and 1,000,000 tales to tell. Only Bobby didn't hear many of them. That was the summer the old, easy friendship among Bobby and Sully and Carol broke up. The three of them sometimes walked down to Sterling House together, but once they got there, they went to different activities. Carol and her girlfriends were signed up for crafts and softball and badminton, Bobby and Sully for junior safaris and baseball. Sully, whose skills were already maturing, moved up from the wolves to the lions. And while all the boys went on the swimming and hiking safaris together, sitting in the back of the battered old Sterling House panel truck with their bathing